Okay, I'm gonna play the music, Brendan.
Go for it. All right. Vince, way to pull that volume down from 69. We're starting on a nice note.
It goes a lot slower than the other parts of my computer.
It's all right. We can change this in post, I think. That's just my excuse for everything. All right, welcome to a very special edition, a mini-series we're doing here on the Film Drunk Frogcast, or just the Frogcast now, I guess.
Unclear.
Unclear. Yeah, we'll see. We'll change that potentially if and when we get the cease and desist from Warner Brothers. Anyway, we are going to do a mini series on college football movies, and who better to have as a guest for our college football series than Mr. Spencer Hall?
How are we doing, boys?
We're doing great.
Doing well, thank you.
We don't have any canned. Applause for you, but I used my hands, and hopefully that's enough for you.
I really appreciate that. Thank you. I am eager to discuss this because I am fresh off the best possible viewing of a 1990s film, which is I caught it in my hotel room when it came on randomly. No purer viewing experience than the midday accidental viewing of a film that I had kind of forgotten about, and that's on me because it's actually a lot better than I remembered.
So this was necessary roughness that you caught in a hotel room by accident.
Yes. Like getting ready to leave somewhere and was late because I had to watch Hector Elizondo do his thing.
It does feel like the ideal cable rewatch
movie.
Like it feels, Brendan, I'll let you continue your intro before we get, too far into specifics of necessary roughness.
Yeah. Just want to make sure we're all properly introduced here. So, of course, we've got Vince, the man behind Film Drunk, and he's got his own Substack now. And we co-founded the Frogcast together. This is for any potential new listeners this might pull in. And,
yeah, people are just coming straight off the street. They got to know
that's right.
The details.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then Spencer has been writing about college football for many years now. He is now at Channel 6 and has been doing the Shutdown Fullcast, which is the internet's only college football podcast,
Thank
I believe.
You.
Can you confirm?
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody else talks about college football on the internet. So now there is a second college football podcast, I guess.
We're going to have to accept that, but the lawyers will be on the way. So be warned.
Okay. All right. This was an idea I had and really appreciate you coming on, Spencer. And what we'd like to do is explore just sort of the world of college football as depicted
the
in
the cinematic
film.
Footprint, if you will.
Exactly. Yeah. The crossover that absolutely nobody asked for between college football or rather the Shutdown Fullcast and Film Drunk Frogcast. So anyway, we can talk both about the worlds that I'm kind of straddling as a college football guy and someone who's been on the Frogcast for a long time. And I think this is a great way to start it because holy hell, is this a movie with some great guys in it?
I feel like there should be more. Do you feel like there should be more college football movies? It doesn't seem like there's that many in the grand scheme of things.
I think it's because it's for the reason there's not a tremendous number of football movies, period. It's a hard sport to convey. It really is. Like, football is a difficult thing to put on film. The best football sequences ever, like the ones in this one, are interesting because there's a lot of offset eye. It's very weird. Like, nobody runs offset eye anymore, but there's some weird, like if you're an X's and O's guy and you're watching what they're doing, you're like, oh, no wonder they're getting killed. Nobody runs that shit anymore. But it's a hard sport to catch on film. So I don't think there's a lot of them. Like, the best football scene I think ever is in a non-football movie. It's the football scene in MASH. Because the football scene in MASH is all violence and non sequiturs and somebody going, I'm going to knock your fucking head off, buddy. It's a lot of that. And it's great. It's everything that a football movie should be. I think there aren't as many college football movies because for a lot of the same reasons that you might hear from advertisers when your college football podcast goes to market, they're like, oh, that's too niche.
What? Too niche? Really?
Yeah,
I feel like it's partly because the people making movies are maybe not like the most the same demographic as
not at all.
That was going to be kind of my response. My response to there not being a lot of college football movies is actually I was going to ask you, Spencer, to relay kind of the Channel 6 and full cast going independent story, right? Your sort of origin story. And I think that's a good anecdote if you wanted to share it.
It is, yeah. Like we were told that our podcast was too niche by a member of the Vox executive staff, and it was for them too niche, but that's what actually thrives on the internet are things that are kind of not wide, but deep. And that's very much a description of, I think, what college football is and certainly what our podcast is by subject matter and in of itself, because I'm afraid that like after doing this for 10 years, we've got so many in jokes and everything. We need a glossary to explain people what we do, which I'm sure y'all are familiar with.
Sure. I mean, that's any podcast, but it seems crazy to me. Like college football is like one of the biggest businesses in the country, right? Like,
The relative lack of interest on the part of people making movies has nothing to do with college football. That's an indictment of the people making movies. And it's also an indictment of scale. Like, I think you can make $100 million on a college football movie. I think you can make $80 million on a college football movie. I don't think you can make $400 million on a college football movie, especially because you have so many things to explain in a very, very short span of time. Now, you give me 10 episodes on Netflix, now we're talking. I think you could do something. I think you could do something absolutely hilarious.
I think that could be amazing. Spencer, can I jump in real quick?
Please.
I would love it if you shared the anecdote about the person pointing at the poster.
Yeah, we did a promo. Yeah. We were in the discussion with the same person and had a promo poster image for our live podcast, which all of our live podcasts sell out. Like we've held them in karaoke joints on the side of a highway in Alabama, and they sell out, right? People show up to these things. And to back up the argument that we were too niche, this person pointed at it and said, "See, I don't know who that is," to a picture of Nick Saban, the winningest college football coach of our era, the one with the most championships. And I'm like, that's
important,
not on me.
Cameo in The Blind Side.
Like, I know, like some people could get mad about that. I'm like, oh, that's not on me. That's not my fault.
Yeah.
This is you.
Yeah, and so it strikes me that like the kind of people who make decisions about media that gets made on a larger scale are largely based in New York and LA, which are just not places where people really get into it. Obviously, SC, when they were, you know, I was in college when they were at the peak of the Pete Carroll years, but still, I'm not sure if that really penetrates the kind of insular world of sort of the country club, you know, people that make
no,
decisions.
No, it's a very funny well, I don't know if you're talking about movies. When Spencer was talking, I was sort of imagining like the New York publishing world, which seems like sort of similar to the tech world, which I've like,
ooh, that's
sort of
that's too narrow. I don't know if you've ever made any book pitch ever. They're like, ooh, that's too narrow, and you're like, I'm gonna write a book about oxygen, bitch. Like, that's it.
You have to pitch like a Malcolm Gladwell thing, like, oh, this is going to be a book about success,
how Henry Kissinger used oxygen,
right? You have to do something which is a pitch directly to dumb guys who want to be smart. That's it. Yes. You want, like, if you could just target dumb guys who want to be smart, like one guy who figured it all out with one simple trick, that's the kind of shit you would have to do. It is, I think, an indictment overall of not just the people who are in charge of things in the media, but the people who are in charge of things generally. Don't listen to them. Oh, they're incompetent. Like, you're like, they can't possibly be incompetent. No, they're all incompetent.
The first sales job I had was inside sales. So I'm like making 100 calls a day trying to sell shit, right?
Yeah.
And I was at a point where I was kind of struggling with it and having a hard time, you know, hitting my numbers. And I asked my boss for help, and he was quite a bit older than me because I was in my mid-20s, and he was like, this is my first job after I got done playing football. And he was probably in his late 30s, early 40s, and he's like, okay, I'm going to help you. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
All right. You're going to read Blink by Malcolm Gladwell, and then you're going to get back to me. And it was sort of this like horrific realization I kind of wasn't in on it, you know, because I read it and I'm like, how the fuck is that going to help me convince people over the phone to buy shit, you know? And he's like, yeah, see, it's all about that, you know? And it came back around to something about how trust your gut, but like, again, it just did not help me at all.
Yeah.
And that's just, it's sort of, it was this realization that like, I'm kind of on the outside looking in when it comes to a lot of this shit.
Yeah.
Because I'm not either gullible enough or wanting to believe enough that this shit is important.
Yeah. You could get invited to the sex parties if you could just buy into whatever the cult is about, but that's really hard to do usually.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, John Dolan, who writes a lot of my favorite like literary takedowns, once wrote like this takedown of I think it was Jonathan Safran Foer, and it was about how Manhattanites are the real hicks because like they always fall for like the corniest humor, and it's like they act like they have not experienced
or put $50,000 in a shoebox and drive.
Yeah, it's like it's like this very like NPR esque bubble, and I feel like I experienced just a tiny bit of it in my brief years in New York, being around like other writers. But yeah, like you start to realize like, oh, this is like this world that everybody talks about. It's like 25 people, and they all sort of know each other, and then they're like really, really dumb on a basic level when it comes to like other types of media that doesn't
in a lot of ways in a lot of ways it feels like the diametric opposite of what Spencer is describing in terms of like people thinking it's too niche, because all those people either went to an Ivy League school or some school I've never fucking heard of with one name that's not the name of a state.
Listen, you know, I can say this here on this, if you went to Oberlin, if I don't know you personally, I assume you're a fucking idiot. I assume you are here to do damage.
Yeah,
like in the same bracket that we're working on for the newsletter, and like the biggest dumbest bitches in history, right? Wayne Wheeler went to Oberlin. Wayne Wheeler was the guy who was behind Prohibition. He was the guy who put poison in industrial alcohol to ensure that it would kill people who made it bootleg shine out of it, and thought it was justified. And he did all of this because when he was a kid, a drunk guy on a farm, some asshole stabbed him with a pitchfork, and he was like, "That's it. No one ever gets to drink booze again." And he just ruined countless lives and enriched some of the biggest assholes in history, not named Wayne Wheeler, as a result of his insane ability to organize politically. Like, yeah, if you went to Oberlin, I'm just like, you're on probation already, buddy. I know what you have to get in there. And one of the things that's required to get in there is a complete lack of touch with reality. Like, you will not have one job skill. Has anyone from Oberlin ever learned to weld? If you have, please. One useful
person. I graduated
person.
From Oberlin, went into the trades. I love
and
it.
By the way, I say this as like a person completely useless with no real skills whatsoever, right? So maybe it's envy. Maybe I'm like, oh man, I should have gone to Oberlin. Would have been around my people.
Brief sidetrack. If I may suggest for the dumb bitch bracket, the guy who basically pushed through all the daylight savings legislation so that he could catch more butterflies. He had more time to catch butterflies.
I kind of respect that. I'm not
going to lie. Like, this is why I'm probably in the dumb bitch bracket too, because I'm like, I don't know. Respect, man. I like that you saw your goals. You created a strategy to achieve them, and you went after it.
Yeah, I'm sick of people rising and grinding, but if one guy's motivation is to like catch more butterflies in his life, I'm like, okay, yeah, let's change time.
Here's my favorite thing to tie it into the movie that we're going to talk about today. My favorite thing about this is a lot of this are very smart people who turn out to be very dumb, and very dumb people who turn out to be very smart. And you have to be ready to be on either side of that fence at any time in life. And that's one thing football's great at, is that we can actually sneak a lot of really smart shit in by starting out assuming everyone's dumb. And then it all kind of rises, because that's happened in football a lot. Like, I know offensive line coaches who are alternately some of the dumbest people and some of the smartest people, because you're like, how did you not figure that out, dude? How can you support this? How can you think that? And then you start to explain what a 5-man slide protection against a 3-3-5 front looks like, and you go, oh, I'm lost. You are clearly brilliant. Like, you are a spatial genius, and we have now entered your realm where I am the moron and you are the genius.
Yeah, Spencer is now touching on my lived experience, which is very dumb, smart guys. So my background
offensive linemen, like some of this, honestly, some of the smartest people I know who have played the dumbest position in one of our dumbest and most beloved games.
Yeah, you're just like the quarterback's bouncer. You're like, nope, go away, away.
You're the quarterback's bouncer.
Run into other people.
Yeah, but you have to anticipate threats in a really like articulate, geometric fashion in real time. And also, you're going to get, that'll be totally ruined when some big oaf next to you falls on your big oaf ass, right?
Yeah, or like, steps on your foot.
Yeah,
stepping on your ankle or your like Achilles looks like the worst part of that.
My dad always said, like, I'm surprised that you don't have to wear steel-toed cleats, which honestly makes kind of sense because like my nails would be falling off halfway through the season, all my toenails.
Yeah, because some 320-pound dude is stepping on your foot half the time. Fuck that.
Plus, if you want to get real arcane with like offensive line technique, you know, if I'm I play tackle, right, and so I would do my kick step, which involves sliding the foot. So oftentimes you get stepped on in the middle of your kick slide. So then you are pulling your foot out at great speed out of a 320-pound man's cleats. Not fun.
Yeah, and you had to do that against guys who had none of the obligations you had. You know what a defensive tackle or a defensive end in that situation is doing? Whatever they want.
Yep.
They're doing whatever you hate. They're like, oh, you're not there. It'd be cool.
Give them a little bit of credit. It's like, run through this gap.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, and if you do it badly, you get a coach that comes in and his motivation is to tell you about how eagles keep crows off of them by flying high up in the sky. I don't even think that is scientifically accurate, let alone like a good metaphor.
Right. Once again, Robert Saleh, like absolute defensive genius, and all the ways Spencer's talking about, even though he's not an offensive line coach, like all the spatial stuff in terms of making sure that you are responding to an offense in real time by getting all your guys in the right place and not having them be obligated to cover too much space. Mm-hmm. Absolute genius shit. And then what happens when you get him in front of a group of people trying to motivate them and starting off your fucking flagship show on HBO, like setting the tone of the entire series? Like, let me talk to you about crows.
Yeah. Sometimes crows, they really try to bring the eagles down. You know what the eagles do? They fucking they fly way up high in the air.
I mean, you know what's happened a lot of times. Like, this is my favorite part, is that coaches know that they have to be doing all this stuff. Right. And players know, all right, I have to be over here for this drill and I have to be over here for this. Right. And in the middle of it, if you watch Nick Saban again, if you're part of the New York media elite, he was the most successful college football coach of the past 50 years, won the most titles and coached at Alabama and LSU.
Not even close, really. Like,
yeah, no, like the best. Even he, there's footage of him sitting around going, who's got my drink? You got my drink? All right. You didn't have my drink yesterday. Like, even he's just like, oh, I got some time to blow. Jesus, I just got to stand here and look. Yeah, there's this whole veil of authority that really, like, everyone knows is there and recognizes as responsible and the thing to do. And they'll also make fun of it. Like they also know to take the piss out of it, which is why I think this movie is so good, because I think it captures that, like, this movie captures the kind of, like, formalized chaos of football and of the organization and the timing and the banter about it. Really, really well. Like, it is hilarious to me that Coach Rigg, who's Robert Loggia's character, when he gets in for the last game, right? When they've just been they've been eating shit all season long. They've just been getting their ass beat. And he goes in at halftime, and Ed Gennaro, the head coach, is in the hospital. So he has to be like the responsible one. And he has to do the like super formal, okay, I'm going to lead men. It's time to lead men. And he walks in and says, let's analyze what's been working for us. He pauses and he just starts to rip his clothes off and he's like, not a goddamn thing. The suit doesn't work. He takes the tie off.
I think I have that clip if we want to play it as like a little intro here. It is, I feel like it is, you know, Robert Loggia is probably the best part of this
movie.
Probably
right
the best
there.
Part of this movie. This scene's probably his best scene. So I'll just play it. Let's not fuck around.
I'll just say while you're pulling that up, I mean, evergreen statement to say Robert Loggia is the best part about this movie.
It's been working for us. Not a goddamn thing's been working for us. Like, this goddamn suit doesn't work for me. And this stinking tie, and this goddamn shirt, it doesn't work for me. You know how to play winning hard-nosed football? You play football like Ed Gennaro played football. A guy who gave his life for this football team. He was a 140-pound halfback, and he played like a goddamn wild man. No, like a goddamn rampaging beast. And that's the way you gotta do it. You go out there, you tear their fucking heads off, and you shit down their necks. Let us pray.
There we go. Like, that to me, that's football. That's college football, which is, I want you to go out there and shit down their necks. Now I'm going to go talk to God.
Yep. Yeah, I always thought that I could have potentially had a case to bring to get rich by bringing a lawsuit, because I went to a state school, and then I always had to do the Lord's Prayer, like, before the game, which is a very football thing. And when you talk to people who aren't in that world, they're like, whoa, what? Like, you prayed before the game? But yeah, football is a very, very religious sport, especially on the West Coast, right? Where that's very not normal to people. It blows people's minds. So I'm like, oh yeah, we had to like say the Lord's Prayer.
This is, that is one element here that like shows me that you understand the heart of what's happening here and where it's from. Another thing that shows me, there's a lot of little touches here where I go, the person here really paid attention and knows what they're talking about. Because one, they choose not one, but multiple possible starting points for the Texas State program, the program in the movie that is the center of the action. It is the main character, essentially, because the whole program's been nuked because they were cheating. And it's SMU, which SMU at one point in 1989, I believe, had to start 41 players. They only had 41 players when most teams have at least 85 on scholarship and then plenty of walk-ons and gray shirts outside. It's also kind of reminiscent of South Carolina 88. I don't know if you know about Joe Morrison of South Carolina. They were cool. Yeah, they legend. Did roids. They did like a lot of roids. They cheated. They wore black. They got South Carolina up to, I believe, a number two ranking, which is in the history of that extremely unsuccessful program that claims like one little half of an ACC championship lifetime, like in the history of the program. This was astonishing. And then immediately Joe Morrison dies and all this shit comes out like, everyone was on roids and players were, you know, like not eligible. And also he brought his mistress to campus along with his wife. Like,
I mean, that's got to be pretty common among college football coaches though, right? Bringing your mistress to campus.
Or maybe they're already there. Maybe they're already there. Bobby Petrino famously wrecked his motorcycle with his girlfriend who worked in the administrative department and showed up to a press conference the next day with road rash on his face and a neck brace, which was just if you are on the college football internet, is just one of the touchstones of being an online college football person, that photo.
Just to back up a little bit, we you know, we're talking Necessary Roughness, 1991. Stan Dragotti is the director. I guess this was his last film. A lot of Italian names in this movie, I noticed.
How you know it's quality.
Yeah, it's how you know it's quality. And of course, we got Scott Bakula as the 34-year-old quarterback that has recruited to come back to the Texas State Fighting Armadillos after he, you know, skipped college because his dad died. And he's being coached by Ed Straight Arrow Gennaro, Hector Elizondo, and of course, Rig Robert Loggia. I feel like this was like 1991 was maybe like the peak of Loggia's career. I mean, he had a long and storied career.
Yeah, but, I think so. We can be not too heavy on college football on this for our more film oriented listeners. This movie is just an incredible cavalcade of guys because the movie opens with Scott Bakula, who's just this great, like skinny fat build. He is throwing 15-yard bombs in his cornfield.
Hey, give him some credit. Like, for an actor, like, he had a plausible arm. Like, he has a much more plausible throwing motion than
he does.
Like 90%
of
actors.
He does. It's clean. It's Rob Johnson-esque, if I can compare it to somebody.
As a heartthrob, I find him curious because, I mean, he is handsome, but he has an odd face. He has, you know, he's got, like, a lot of nose and squinty eyes. I feel like the key to being a male heartthrob is those squinty eyes, though. People love those.
The funny thing is he's supposed to be 34 in the movie, and usually you have people who are much older playing much younger people. In this case, he was 36 during the movie, so he's pretty close to his stated age. He looks like he's 45.
Yeah.
But, you know, starting on Scott Bakula, the movie opens with him, right? And when it does go to the wide shots, it is pretty funny that, while his throwing motion is convincing, and that's good enough for most football movies, there are some wide shots where he's got to hit the dummy that he has, and he's like 15 yards away, but it's like making it like he's just gunning, you know, the ball. You know, he's doing like a Joe Milton throwing the ball the length of the field. But we see him, there's a quick sequence of him in his field chucking the ball at this dummy. So it establishes he's a great quarterback. Immediately cut to Chris Berman, who interestingly enough seems unable to read off this particular teleprompter, even though, you know, he's pretty good at that in real life. And he's talking to Hector Elizondo. And you're getting the whole idea, you're getting the background that this is sort of an SMU situation. I kind of, that's how I interpreted it, because it is a Texas school. SMU, famously, the book written about all the shit they were doing is called A Payroll to Meet, which, you know, if you don't want to go deep, is really all you need to know. However, I do recommend the book. It's incredible. And then cut to Fred Thompson. Fred Thompson walks in.
Future senator.
Yes, we are already lousy with guys, and we are like 2.5 minutes into this movie.
We haven't even got to the part where Paul Giamatti's brother plays a psychotic military guy in this, which is a funny character in 1991. I guess it was in the build up to the Gulf War, because looking at it with the benefit of time, you think of like the 80s to the early 90s as this sort of Belle Epoque era where, like, you know, we had no wars and everybody was wondering what the army was supposed to do anymore.
He does say something like they left faster than the Republican Guard when they're doing the tryouts and running everyone off. So the implication is like he just got back from Desert Storm.
Yeah, so you got Paul Giamatti's brother. You got Larry Miller as the shitty dean.
Who's outstanding.
Doing a great job.
And the second you see him, I mean, when you see Larry Miller come on screen, you're like, oh, there's an uppance, and it's coming to him.
yeah. You're like, who's there's the dick. That's the dickhead. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Sinbad, of course, gets in there as like the chemistry, like, as you were just saying, like the stereotype of the, I guess he was a defensive lineman though, but
no, he was offense.
Well, he played both ways
on
the
team. Both ways. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause everyone had to play both ways. Cause they had no depth.
Yeah.
So, which again, this is why I think the person who wrote this. Okay. And I have not looked up the screenwriter, but compliments to them, because there are a lot of things which are a stretch from reality, but not that far. That far, brother. So
this is it's very clearly like a comic book type of writing of a movie. But I mean, that's canon for any inspirational like sports comedy. Like I sort of, you know, you accept the thing that I feel like makes this such a good cable movie, and I remembered this almost encyclopedically, like this was the movie that we would quote lines from when I was playing Pop Warner, which I did for 2 years in junior high. Like we would Round Right 22 Trap, like I remember that, like it's burned into my brain. But like watching it from start to finish is really funny, because you think there's more of the movie than you remember. But it really just is a collection of sort of memorable vignettes. And the writing is very much like set up, immediate punchline, well-constructed set up punchline.
Thank you for noting that, by the way. There's a lot of snappy like 2 and 3 line construction.
It's great. No, like I think, like, you know, if you like comedy and corny, like traditional comedy, like the setup punchline of this is just wonderful in a lot of ways. I'm trying to remember like specific lines
One that's my favorite, and it's very coach speak and appropriate. Gennaro says, hey, did you hire an assistant coach without telling me, when Scott Bakula, 34-year-old Scott Bakula, is walking up, and Robert Loggia goes, no, I found a quarterback without telling you. And Gennaro goes, well, I hope he gets younger as he gets closer. What kind of meow meow lines? I love that.
That's very coach speak. When I get together with my buddies and we tell our old war stories, that we had this crusty defensive coordinator who just had the best one-liners. And he told one guy who he was always on for being too dumb that if he put his brain in a bird, it would fly backwards. Which is just like such good.
I think my favorite I've heard is that that boy's so dumb that he drowned looking up in a rainstorm. That's a good one.
He told our scout team QB that he had a leg for an arm, which I also really enjoyed.
Oh, there's another moment. I really like the sequence when Gennaro goes to the hospital because he thinks he's having a heart attack, and then the doctor comes in. He says, "You got a hiatal hernia. It's basically, you know, it's causing angina." And he's like, "Am I gonna be okay? Like, is that gonna kill me?" He's like, "Indigestion? Not unless you go to Tijuana. What was that line?
Yeah, not unless you're in Mexico.
Yeah, not unless you're in Mexico. Solid line. Can I just mention
one scene? So there's a scene. So Gennaro comes in. He's the straight arrow. He once kicked 5 All-Americans off his team for, I don't know, cheating on a test or something. So it's established that he's the guy who's going to do it by the book, which through the lens of today seems very quaint, which I sort of appreciated. Definitely was of its time. But they also establish, okay, there's a scene where there's open tryouts and there's all this, you know, the misfits of campus kind of coming to try out. And there's the scene in the gym where we are introduced to Giamatti's character and they're getting put through all these workouts and guys are quitting. And that's when he says, you know, the Republican Guard left or ditched, didn't even ditch as quick as these guys. But I just always wanted to point out the thing that really sticks out to me about this scene is that as a young, aspiring football player, Hollywood really had me believing that I was going to be spending a significant amount of time as a football player just like standing in place chopping my feet.
Yeah.
Like that's a staple of like almost every football movie.
Yeah. Yeah. So another thing that
sorry, I should add, I never did that. And I don't really understand. I mean, I did the chopping feet for up downs, mm-hmm. but like you never see him doing up downs in the movie. I think Rudy maybe does some up downs, but
yeah, there's a little bit of that there.
Yeah. I never understood that.
There's fewer training montages and calisthenics than you would expect from a football movie. But
yes.
I was sort of reminiscing about Roadhouse this past week. And I feel like what this movie and that movie have in common, like 80s and 90s movies, there was always one really fat guy in the cast, and mm-hmm. we've sort of gone away from that. And it's such a joy to see a big fat guy on screen. Like it's just,
one who's given such dignity. Like that's the thing.
Yes.
One who's given a tremendous amount of dignity and who introduces himself with, "I'm the run of the litter."
Yeah. And that was Peter Navy Tuisasopo playing Manu Mana. I think he is what was Marcus? I think he's Marcus Tuisasopo's cousin.
There are several Tuisasopos who are all very gifted athletes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how much being a cousin means when you're Samoan. I feel like most other Samoans are probably
it means they'll show up to a fight. And that's all you need. Then that's all you need to know.
Yeah. I wanted to say that they did portray the Samoan very accurately in my lived experience.
Yeah, incredibly polite, but also violent when yes. push comes to shove. Yeah.
We'll absolutely crush skulls.
Gonna get
in
it
your
done.
Defense, if necessary.
Gonna get it done. Yeah.
Yeah. He plays the center, and he eventually falls in love with the kicker that they recruit, the hot lady kicker, Kathy Ireland, which I feel like she counts as a guy.
And I was going to say guys because, one, there's like 2 women in this entire movie, and 2, like guys is not necessarily a gendered term the way we use it. I did like the way they recruited her from the soccer team because that's also true to life. That mm-hmm. happens at the high school level quite a bit. And also the first woman to play in a Division I game was a female soccer player, or at least a high school female soccer player who then went on and kicked at New Mexico and actually played against her. So that's my connection to this.
Did you knock her down and say welcome to football?
No, I didn't get a chance to do that. I did have a guy that I trained with who played against her and blocked a kick and talked shit to her, and I was like, "Really, dude?" And he's like, "Yeah, man." Like, he was like a little aggro. He's like,
"Step in the ring."
Yeah, there's a lot of guys who can't do this shit. You think a woman can? Like, all right, man.
So yeah, as good as Scott Bakula's arm was, they really could have maybe got like a better stunt double for Kathy Ireland's kicks.
They really put all the attribute points into attractiveness with her.
Yeah, they really. There's no way any of those kicks were getting back to the line.
Yeah, it's harder than you think. Like go try to hit one from 25, man. It is not easy.
Well, no. I've tried to do it with my stepson, and like it like tears my groin off of my body every time I do it, and I'm like limping for the next
week. It's not about Kathy Ireland not being able to make a 25-yard field goal. It's about Kathy Ireland not being able to make a convincing kicking motion.
Yeah, well, and for me, it's also about the confusion of like you don't have to film her from the front. Like you can use a stunt double with the ponytail and all of those shots. Yeah. Like just shave a guy's leg. Like you're fine.
Yeah, I feel like that another realistic thing in this is the I think Bakula turns out that was realistic. Like, oh, go get a 34-year-old quarterback. That's what they were doing by the end of the 90s. That's what people would still do now.
Yeah, right? That's like normal now. Every quarterback.
Chris Wanky came back at 28, 29. Yeah. Like,
and now you have the COVID years. So yeah, there's guys who are like, you know, old enough to rent a car running offenses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another realistic thing too is this, that Ed Gennaro is straight arrow Gennaro. And the minute he gets on the scene, he's like, yes, I'm going to follow all the rules. And he's bending everything at the edges as hard as he can. Yes. Right. Like he's again, very coach like to be like, yep, we're going to do everything right. And if I don't have to do it right, I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah. I also think like this movie, you know, it's not like a great movie, but I feel like it sort of succeeds on that like perfect hook / wish fulfillment level where it sort of, it combines your underdog inspirational sports movie with old school a little bit. Like it's like, mm-hmm. you're so, like, I watched it as a kid and it has like the hook of like, oh, cool. Underdog sports movie, and then watching it as an adult, you kind of get that jolt of wouldn't it be cool if I could go back to college and play like football like I was 19 again. Obviously, like, my bones would turn to dust if I tried to do that, but it's one of those it plays on that desire. Yeah, that fantasy.
Yeah. I one thing that stood out to me, there's a couple things actually. So obviously Texas State is a fictional university here. It's supposed to be SMU, most likely. The first team they play it was Texas State, right? So then the first team they play is Southwestern Texas, which are the Bobcats, which ends up looking exactly like Texas State, which was not a football program when this movie was made, who is now playing in Division I, who is the Bobcats, and has like very similar colors, which was very weird. All the teams they play are fictional. Except the second to last game where they tie, they play Kansas.
Oh, right. Yeah, the Jayhawks. Yeah, that was an interesting choice.
It was very
choice.
Weird, and I would love to know how that worked, but it's also very funny because Kansas has notoriously, for very long periods of time, been absolute dog shit at football, and it's almost like they were so desperate, they're like, no, please, like, just put us in the movie. Like, we'll do anything. You don't have to pay for it.
There's another interesting thing here where you have these two twin brothers that are like semi-albino. According to IMDb, their characters are named Olaf Knudsen and Ingmar Knudsen. And I have to think, like, in the script, they were trying to do like a Hansen Brothers thing from Slapshot.
Absolutely.
But like they must have cut all of their scenes out because they're just they're sort of in the background. They're not like, there's no, everybody
they're,
else
they're
has,
also sort of established early too. So you're like, oh, these are going to be some guys.
Is going to be a cool Hansen Brothers sort of thing. And like, nah.
Just cut them. Just like football. Thought we were going to depend on them. Nope. Cut them.
It's like they had too many vignettes and gimmicks for a single movie, and they just sort of like stuffed them all together. Yeah. And they're like, "All right, we need at least 6 minutes for like Holyfield and Jim Kelly cameos from the prison team," which I could have done without that scene. But
it's
sure,
so weird. And then, of all people, they have Dick Butkus talk, and he comes out and he goes like, "Well, as local fans and boosters of the Texas State Armadillos, we just want to give you a good scrimmage and help you guys get better."
Just hitting them with that yat straight out? Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah. And
it's sort of a weird assemblage, too, because it's like Dick Butkus. It's Evander Holyfield, who is a boxer. It is Jerry Rice, which, like, sure,
great, he's a football player, not the toughest looking guy,
it's guy Jerry Rice in his braid. I think he has the high top fade. Yeah,
and then it's the name escapes me, but like a famous Raider, which is like, okay, he's like a Raider, he's one of the bad boys. But that's when it's like, okay, but then Jerry Rice doesn't really fit that profile as much.
No.
And same with like Roger Craig.
Yeah.
Another great player. Vince and I are Niner fans, so, you know, endless love for those guys. But like, yeah, seems a little bit of a weird kind of
I want to say that was
there.
That Too Tall Jones in there? I don't know all of my
Ed Too Tall Jones.
Right. He's, so who and then who is the white guy with the Fu Manchu?
He's a Raider and I forget his name.
Todd Marinovich? Or is it it's either him or it's
I want to say like Ted Hendricks, but it's not Ted.
Not John Matuszak. It's not.
I just saw the facial hair, and I was like, "Is that like Catfish Hunter? Who is that guy? This guy is like one of those sports guys that's like a little too old for me to remember."
Yeah,
Ben Davidson.
Ben Davidson. Okay.
Yes, and then Jim Kelly is the quarterback.
Which again, like non sequitur. Like, what's Jim Kelly doing there?
Right. Oh, yeah. Another guy that's like, okay, good football player. He does not read like tough guy straight out of prison like, to me.
Convict. Yeah.
Yeah. We found a guy.
Yeah. Exactly. He was available that weekend.
I mean, Evander Holyfield's line read of "I think I swallowed a finger." You know, like again, every scene has a button in this. Like every setup has a punchline.
And yeah. Guys, I gotta run. I have booked yet another podcast right behind y'all.
All right.
This one I get paid for.
That could be a good segue into the other two guys I just wanted to mention were we see these guys have proper names, but we all know them as film and college football aficionados as Latimer and Alvin Mack. They show up in this movie, and that might be a good foreshadow to another episode that we have with Spencer Hall, because we will undoubtedly cover the program, a legendary college football movie. Spencer, thanks so much for coming on. And do you want to plug anything? Where can we find you?
Absolutely. You can go read the Dumb Bitches of History bracket.
It literally just hit my inbox. I'm very excited. Yeah,
my newsletter that I have with Holly Anderson. We do two things a week. I suggest you subscribe to it and give me money, because I will produce plenty of words for you. And then in addition to that, you can listen to us on the Shutdown Fullcast. I do Big Dumb Football on YouTube for ESPN, and I do all kinds of other stuff for them as well. So, you know, three or four jobs. That's all.
Yeah, I follow the Fullcast, have been for a long time, and I subscribe to Channel 6. Suggest all you do as
Thank
well,
you.
Even if you're not massive college football fans. There's all sorts of arcana and fun, interesting stuff. Case in point, the Dumb Bitch Bracket. Not Dumb college football related at all, and plenty of people who may not be college football heads listening to this, I think, would enjoy it. So, Spencer, Thank you. Vince and I can wrap this up. I think there's a few more points we want to talk about, but we will see you again shortly, my friend.
All right, thanks, y'all. Go Armadillos.
Thanks for joining us. Yeah, they also, you know, TSU, Texas State, and I like the way it's rendered, the logo that they created for it, which just looks like stew. Like every shot, it looks like you know the stew fighting armadillos. Yeah, it's kind of funny. The Latimer, I'm trying to remember his name. Oh, Andrew Briniarski, who I think made a career out of doing high school and college football movies in the early 90s.
Wasn't he in Any Given Sunday as well?
He's in Any Given Sunday. I'm looking at his IMDb right now. We got to go back to, because I remember him from The Program, obviously. This, I almost forgot that he was in it. Rollerball, Pearl Harbor, Any Given Sunday, a bunch of the 1995.
Didn't they remake Rollerball with like Jean Reno or something?
I don't remember. He played Zangief in the Jean-Claude Van Damme Street Fighter movie.
Nice.
I didn't remember what I remembered him from. He was what is that guy with the cool accent? That everybody does. Oh, Christopher Walken's son in Batman Returns. He played like they cast him against type as like the wimpy fail son, which is just kind of a stroke of genius casting on that.
Yeah, that feels very inspired. I don't recall that, but I'm like quite intrigued. I have not seen Batman Returns in quite a long time. So
great one. I'm a huge Batman Returns fan, but he was Christopher Walken's son. Christopher Walken was like a wealthy and corrupt industrialist, and he had a gentle son named Chip, played by Latimer from The Program. Very, very inspired there. But this was another character that you sort of expected there to be more from, because every single character has a gimmick. You know, you got the karate guy who talks about respect, and he's sort of a twist on the voodoo guy from Major League. Like, this movie and Major League have very much like transposed in my mind to the point
that's a good point
there's a scene in this. So Gennaro goes to the hospital for his chest pains, and there's a great scene where Rig keeps treating him like he's dying, and he's like, dude, you don't have to, like, I'm here in the hospital. I'm fine. I'm good. And I, in my head, I could have sworn that Gennaro told him, like, whatever you do, don't give him one of those win one for the Gipper speeches. And then there's like a smash cut to the scene we played with Robert Loggia in the locker room. And he says, you know, the last thing that Gennaro said to me was, his last words to me were, win or I'll die, which is a great punchline. And I could have sworn the don't give him one of the win one of the, for the Gipper speeches was the setup for it. And I actually asked Spencer about this on Twitter, and a bunch of people piped up, a bunch of people that remembered it the way I did. And then another subset of people were like, no, that's actually from Major League 2, where he says, you know, don't give him one of these corny, like, win one for Lou speeches. And I think
I can definitely see Lou delivering that line.
Yes. Like, and I think I transposed the two in my mind because this is such a, like, setup punchline driven movie. And don't give him the win one for the Gipper speech, smash cut to win or I'll die, is such a perfect setup punchline that I think I retroactively, like, combined the two into one perfect scene in my brain.
Got it. Yeah, I don't remember. Like, I've seen this movie a couple times prior to this latest rewatch. It's not a movie I remember super well, though. I do. When I was in college, there was a lot of I thought you were going to do one of these, like when we were fucking around, before practice. Thought you were going to do one of these. That was a line we used a lot. But
I just read William Goldman's memoir, famous screenwriter, and I think this might have been from Ed Zwicks, but. Basically, he was like, there aren't hits and flops. There aren't good movies and bad movies. There's really only two types of movies, which is like movies that you remember and movies that you don't. And like watching this, I was really struck by how much of it that I had retained, like almost the entire movie, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wasn't so much, but I hadn't seen it that many times. I can't call it a good movie, but
no, I wouldn't either.
I was entertained while watching it. I think, you know, I think actually the Major League versus Necessary Roughness is a really good way of looking at it, because the first Major League is an amazing movie. That is just a classic. It's so funny. The characters are so good. And I think like this is sort of an example of maybe trying to do something like that and not executing as well, because to your point, especially like about the brothers, you know, you're sort of like, oh, we're really going to get to know these guys and they're going to get into all sorts of hijinks and be, you know, punching each other and saying, you know, mom liked me better or whatever. Right. Like you're kind of expecting that's where it's going to go. And then you just never see those guys again.
Yeah. It feels like they had more sketches than they could fit in the movie, and they just sort of stuck them all together without a ton of setup or connective tissue. And the little vignettes you do, I did remember, but yeah, like as a movie from start to finish, you're like, wow, I feel like this movie needed like some more room to breathe or some.
Yeah. It really felt like they didn't do a good job, maybe where Major League did, of figuring out who the characters are that they're really going to focus on and kind of flesh out. Because there's some, like at one point Jason Bateman gets his kind of spotlight where, you know, my dad's going to blah, blah. Yeah. And
rich son of a booster. Yeah.
I kind of remember being like, well, I saw his face, but like, he hasn't really been in this movie.
Yeah. I think the major flaw of it is, you know, like the underdog inspirational sports movie is such an established format that you kind of have an expectation that they're going to adhere to these tropes, so in this movie, like they have a lot of characters and you forgive the fact that they all have very like transparent skin deep gimmicks. The part that trips you up is that they introduce some that they just never really develop. You know, I think Major League, they really, like you said, they found a few and they really developed them all. And it didn't feel like there was parts of it left on the cutting room floor and things that they forgot to develop like they did with this. Like the twins, you forget that they're there. You probably didn't need them. Well, there's a lot of them. There's a lot of characters. And then just the way that I think they only have about six games, like they lose. There's sort of a montage of them losing the first five games. Then they have the tie against the Jayhawks in the rain. And then there is like the finale showdown with the Texas Colts, which I assume was like the Longhorns.
The Longhorns. Yeah.
And like they have a bar fight with those guys, but they never really like establish them as the big bads very much. And it's just sort of like fast forward to, okay, there's going to be a climactic showdown and they're going to beat him somehow.
Yeah. Also, something that struck me as funny about this movie is like, at least in, again, go back to Major League, it's a baseball season, so there's enough time for them to suck and then turn it around, right?
Yeah.
Whereas in this, it's like there's six games, and then they've got to establish they suck, so it takes four games to establish that. Right. There's two games left. So then they win the final game against the big rivals to push their record to 1-4-1 on the season, and they're like, it's just it really cracked me up about how low stakes it ended up being.
Right.
They have incredibly low stakes.
They have one big bad guy, which is Flat Top, who plays for the Colts, played by this guy, Tom Whitenight, who was clearly like a big guy. He sort of has a cleft palate, and he's got the look of like a big corn-fed football player.
Yes.
Not like a tremendous actor, I wouldn't say.
No.
But just like the level of, yeah, you guys get it. He's the big bad guy. They're going to beat him. They didn't really bother explaining it much more than that.
No, they definitely didn't establish like why. I mean, it's sort of like, I don't even necessarily know if it's established that like this is a traditional big rivalry.
No, we're just in, like, we don't really find that until Rob Schneider's like doing the exposition as they're doing the coin toss in that game. In fact, like Ed Gennaro goes to the hospital and says, you can take the whistle. We have a game tonight. And that game happens to be like the huge rivalry game that this entire movie has been building towards. And we literally like don't find out about it until the morning of in movie time.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting movie. I do think it sort of works for what it is, though.
Yeah, it's cromulent and it's digestible. I can't quite go all the way as to say it's a good movie.
Right.
It's a good movie that you should run out and watch.
They don't like give you little breadcrumbs of they don't build a lot of anticipation by like giving you bits of information and letting there be some suspense there. Like going back to Major League, because it is weird how similar of movies they are, but like in the first Major League, you sort of have the evil owner lady and she's trying to tank. She's trying to tank the season, and the entire conflict of the movie is that this ragtag band of baseball players is going to make the evil owner look bad by winning when she wants to tank. And they even have that standee of her where with every game they like take a piece of clothes off. Like that was just a very,
you guys suck.
Yeah. A very well rendered way to sort of build anticipation and build suspense towards like their eventual triumph. Here, like, you have the exact same format where you have like the evil Dean played by Larry Miller, and he does sort of want the team to lose, but it's not fully articulated. And
it doesn't necessarily seem like he has any power to do anything, right?
No.
That's the conflict of Major League, is that this is the owner and she's going to like fuck everything up. And he doesn't really seem to have much power because Fred Thompson is the president. And he's the one who, of course, when I mentioned earlier that Uppins was going to come, he says, "You're fired," right? So what was he doing? Because he didn't have any power to do anything in the first place.
No.
So what are we doing here? It's not a very well constructed movie.
Like, yeah, it's like the movie version of a girl who looks hot from about 50 yards away, and then like the closer she gets, the more you realize that she's not actually that cute, but she has all of the trappings of hotness.
Yeah, it's like an Instagram model where it's like, okay, like nice hair, makeup, eyebrows are manicured, but like there's not much else there.
Yeah. I appreciated the love interest. I forget her name. She's also from like Parenthood.
Harley Jane Kozak.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah. And we find out that she sort of has this budding romance with Paul Blake, played by Scott Bakula, and then we find out that she had a crush on him in high school, and
yeah,
it's like a big reveal. That was about like the most deep character development that they did mm-hmm. in the movie. Most of the rest of it was just, you know, here's a fun scene of them doing goofy stuff on a football field.
Even Scott Bakula, who, you know, I think Spencer made a good point that Texas State is the main character, but you could argue that Scott Bakula is the lead. He's the main human character. You don't really get much else from him besides he was a good football player. He likes to win, and his dad died, so he took over the duties of the farm. Like, there's not really much else there.
Yeah, we learned nothing about, we didn't even know what kind of farm it was or like what he's been doing for the entire like past 20 years. But
I think we see some beeves when Robert Loggia drives up. Great needle drop. All my exes live in Texas. The guys here are not limited to screen rendering. We hear George Strait fairly early in the movie. One note I have from here is, have you really lived until you've driven a big fuck off car through Texas with the top down? That just made me, I was like, oh shit, I'm missing that piece.
And he's driving it with his cowboy hat on, even though the car has like no windows or doors, which I don't think that hat was going to stay on.
No, but so I do think it's a cattle farm, but again, not much character development.
It's sort of just like most of this movie was just like, you guys get it, right? You get what we're trying to. It's Texas. There's cows. You got it. We're moving on.
Yeah. No, I really think the thing that sticks with me, Vince, is what you said, where it's they're trying to do a Major League-esque movie. And everything that is good about Major League is maybe things they tried to do here that just weren't executed as well. And that's what keeps this from being like a stone cold classic. But it's also just a really good college football movie. And if you want to get technical, some of the things I actually liked is a movie that comes to mind, not a college football movie, but Remember the Titans, just has the most ridiculous football scenes. Every scene is like a guy getting hit and doing like four backflips. It's like,
yeah. Didn't they give the extras like 10 concussions shooting that movie or something?
Oh, did like they? That. Yeah. I'm like, yeah. Did John Woo direct this? Like, what is.
It's like, see, a John Woo like, football movie. I feel like football is a little bit like boxing in that we already have such a strong mental image of what it's supposed to look like that to try and do a movie version is really hard, and you kind of almost have to stylize. You almost have to take it to a place of stylization so that you're not trying to compete with the reality that we already know. Like one of the football scenes that sticks out in my mind as like a great movie football scene is in The Last Boy Scout, where that guy fields the kickoff and pulls a pistol out and is like shooting people on the way down the field.
Yeah,
that was a good one. You're freezing on me. I can't tell if you're waiting to talk or not. Uh-oh, his face is dissolving into pixels. What do I do? I can't fill space now. Oh, no. All right, you're unfrozen, it looks like.
Oh, yes.
There we go.
Yeah, okay. I heard you about The Last Boy Scout before I froze out, but which I agree with. The football scenes, while there are plenty of, like, you know, guy gets hit and flies 10 feet in the air, there's a few of those, but like a surprising amount of relatively realistic looking football scenes too.
Mm-hmm.
Which I remember it being kind of cartoon football. And I had forgotten maybe that there was a little more restraint shown in some of these. One thing that they do in movies a lot that you don't see as much in the real thing is the shit talking just doesn't happen as much, mostly because everyone's tired and you have too much shit to think about. But right, there is some shit talking. I definitely, in my career, was in a stance being like, you fucking suck, dude.
It definitely doesn't have, it doesn't rely on that as much as like the program where, you know,
oh yeah,
you're the program, you're the there's like motherfucker who fucked my sister or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's full like one act plays in between snaps in the program.
Yeah. There's like an Australian guy in this movie and he's another character that didn't really quite get developed. And it's like, he's an actual Australian guy, but he sort of, he looks like an Italian guy from Staten Island, and it almost feels like an Italian dude from New York doing an Australian accent. It's like, it's almost too understated to like read as Australian, and he basically has like one or two scenes and doesn't really factor into it at all.
Yeah, he says pads are like for sissies or whatever, and then gets knocked out. Mm-hmm. But he holds on to the ball and then it's like, oh, okay. Yeah. We're going to see him again. Yeah. Yeah, he's probably going to do some crazy Aussie rules thing. And then like, I don't think we see him again. I don't remember seeing him again.
Yeah. He says something about like, oh, they let Sheila's on the team. it was like, I think that is like sort of the glaring flaw I think the underdog sports movie format is just such a winning format. And this movie has all of the basic parts of that to achieve that formula. But there are many setups that don't quite get punchlines and they stick out in your mind because it's otherwise so utilitarian.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think that's all I had that I wanted to talk about. I mean, it's a good movie. I don't know if there's like that much meat on the bone to like explain. No. Oh yeah. Emptying out the notebook, Philly special. They ran Philly special in the movie.
Right.
That was cool.
What did they call it? They just called it a quarterback option, I think, right?
Yeah, they called it quarterback option, which, like, if you want to get technical, is usually the quarterback taking the ball and running parallel to the line of scrimmage, and he has an option to pitch it to the halfback or keep it. You see, like, the service academies do this a lot. You don't see it in the pros very much. But
yeah, it's sort of like they transpose the halfback option where the halfback has the option to pass
or throw or run. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, and they always throw and they rarely complete it.
Should have called it a Texas special, you know? It
was right yeah. There. Yeah. But nonetheless, they run Philly special, which also didn't they run that in Little Giants?
I don't know. It's been 20 years since I saw that movie.
I think they ran it in Little Giants. Yeah. There's another thing that kind of cracked me up that made it very about its time was there was like an Edward Scissorhands reference.
Mm-hmm.
because Alvin Mack's character can run, but he can't catch.
Yeah. Very, Ted Ginn / Aguilar character. I think we got everything we needed to out of it.
I think we got everything we needed.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, yeah, this is going to be the first in a series. We're really excited to keep exploring these movies. There is an oeuvre of solid college football movies, even though, to Spencer's point, it is an underrepresented genre. But we will do our best to highlight some of our favorites. So excited to work on the rest of this series. And Vince, anything else you want to add or you want to plug or anything?
No, I think they mostly know all the stuff. I got my Substack, vincemancini.substack, and obviously the Wire podcast and the Frotcast that you're probably already have heard if you're subscribed to this feed. And yeah, that's pretty much it for me.
Awesome. Yeah. If you have any suggestions, feedback, whatever you want to tell me to suck your dick, frotcastbrendan@gmail.com. Thanks for emailing me and love hearing from the listeners. So let us know how we did. Let us know what you'd like to hear. We have obviously some movies in mind, but I'm open to suggestions if there are any movies we haven't thought about that listeners really want to hear about. So thanks for listening. And we will be back with our next movie, to be determined, soon. And we will see you then. Thanks, everyone.
All right.